Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Sideways with Sue Jones. She looks at the dangers of hair dye and investigation. Also, George Butler runs a radio show in Austin, Texas, called The Secret Truth. We talk to him about the prospects for America under Trump and a favourite subject of Texans, gun control. Also, James Files. He's the grassy knoll assassin that killed John F. Kennedy. Even though the mainstream media has not told you about him, there's lots of interesting interviews with him on YouTube. But this week, we hear a clip from an interview, long interview with James Files, where he talks about David Ferry, also Lee Harvey Oswald, and the strange death of Officer Tippit. The day Kennedy was assassinated is explained. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. And I'll give you all the contact details at the end of the show. Now, wandering around most towns and cities, you will find places like Boots and Superdrug, almost an entire shelf of the shop, going right the way from one end to the other, is full of hair dyes. Personally, I always walk straight past them, but actually there's quite a lot of people that don't. 10% of men and 60% of women actually dye their hair. But the question we're looking at today on Sideways with Sue Jones is, how dangerous is your hair dye? So Sue, that 60% of women and 10% of men, how do we know that? Is that a proper good, well-sourced figure?
I think it is. I found that from a Guardian article, but when I was researching this, I found it in two or three other places as well. I found an estimate in America of 70% of women. And when I look around myself, rarely do I see a woman who hasn't dyed her hair to some extent, I think, apart from maybe some older people.
Okay, so how big is this industry? And it does worry me to think that quite a lot of nasty chemicals are going to be in there, but how big is the hair dye industry in the world?
It's huge. It's the biggest branch of the beauty industry. It accounts for a quarter of the whole of its revenue.
I thought you were going to say it's the biggest part of the chemical industry. Quite so big, but no. of the beauty industry. Okay.
So worldwide, it accounts for £155 billion.
Massive.
Yeah, and that's growing. So that'll go up a quarter in about 3 or 4 years.
Okay, so what's the average cost, not that I'm actually asking for my own personal benefit, of getting your hair dyed or coloured?
Well, I don't know personally because I'm one of the minority of women who don't do it, but I'm told it's £90 is the average cost of a cut and colour.
Okay, so that's if you're going to have it done at the hairdressers. What about just if you're doing it at home?
I don't know.
Just the cost,
so,
I suppose,
yes, I
of your time.
A few pounds.
And a few pounds for the hair dye.
Yeah.
So what's the problem with it, apart from the cost?
Well, there's two possible problems, the effect on health and the effect on the environment. Now, there's been lots of research about the effect on health and not much at all about the effect on the environment, which is quite a neglected area.
So is that, I suppose, flushing this stuff down the loo or down the sink plug hole or whatever?
Yeah, that's largely, it goes into the water systems. But also, you know, if you throw a bottle away and you haven't used it all, then it'll go into landfill and then leach down through the soil into the groundwater as well.
Okay, what about health effects more directly? And I wonder, I'm hoping that these are thoroughly tested before they're allowed to be used.
Well, there's a few loopholes, it seems to me, and it's a continuing story. They keep discovering things and then they keep saying, oh, we'd better not have that in their hair dyes, and then they keep banning them. So, for instance, there was quite a few things that were banned in the 1970s where there were real, you know, quite strong links with cancer. So they got rid of those. And then since then, there have been more bans. So the EU has banned, in 2007, it banned 179 chemicals that could be found in hair dyes. And even in 2010, they banned another 22. So you wonder how many more are still there that shouldn't be. And the Basically, the worst problems come with the permanent or the semi-permanent colours. The temporary colours, they're not so bad, because when you get a temporary colour, you might get it an artificial one, or you might use henna. But what that does basically is kind of stain the outside of your hair. So it doesn't do anything very radical. It just colours the outside of your hair. But when you get a permanent colour or semi-permanent, that is a nastier process altogether, because first of all, you've got to get a chemical that will separate the outer covering of the hair, which is the cuticle, that's got to sort of lift that off, so that it's usually ammonia that does that. And then in goes the hydrogen peroxide, which neutralizes the color and kind of, you know, gets rid of the colour that you've already got. And then you've got the chemical actually gives you whatever colour you've chosen. And you have to leave that on your head for about 30 minutes while there's this chemical interaction going on. I can see the expression on your face, Tony. It is quite astonishing. And funnily enough, it was discovered when a chemist was looking for the cure to malaria. And he came out with mauve colouring. Which wow. became hair, you know, when he was looking at coal tar.
Okay, so what are the actual bad health effects? You mentioned cancer there. Have you got a list of things that will, if you're starting to get these kinds of things happening, if you are dyeing your hair, that you should just stop immediately? Do you know what know, specific problems there are?
There are some specific chemicals that there are problems with. One of them is PPD, and I'll try and get that right. I think it's called phenylenediamine. Now, that is something that you get out of coal tar. It's been banned in makeup, but it's not banned in hair dye. But, of course, hair dye goes on your skin, just like makeup does. And, you know, it can cause problems. Now, there's also another lovely thing that you get in dyes, particularly the ones that men use to progressively darken their hair, is lead acetate. And, of course, lead's not a great thing to have near you, is it? And you get it at higher levels than is allowed in house paint. So those are the sort of nasty chemicals that there are around.
Are you telling me it's actually safer to paint your hair with a paintbrush than it is to dye it?
It sounds like it, yeah. Okay.
Okay, how do you reduce the risk anyway?
Right, so then you asked, what are the effects? So,
okay, sorry, yeah.
One is the direct effect on the skin, so you can get dermatitis. And after florists, hairdressers, it's the second commonest occupation for getting contact dermatitis. You can have an allergy, and it's the ammonia that produces that. You can have an allergy. Some people get a very severe reaction, which can kill them, but that's very rare indeed. But 1.5% of the population are allergic to this chemical I said, the PPD, so... You know, they could suffer.
Would it be actually marked on the side of the hair dye that it's got PPD in it?
I don't know, but this is why they always advise you to do a skin test before you use it, 48 hours before. So do not skimp on that. I'm a great one for not bothering with instructions and just plunging in regardless, but do that skin test. You don't want to be one of the people who gets a really nasty rash as a result. And even if you've used it for years, you know, it can accumulate and then suddenly it'll affect you, which it didn't before. It can be linked to the respiratory problems like asthma and that sort of thing. Again, the ammonia in the air when they're doing these treatments. And then, of course, there's cancer. There's mixed evidence on this, but... On the whole, it looks like you're twice as likely to get bladder cancer if you use hair dyes regularly. And I'm talking about the permanent ones, as I said here.
So how does that work? That just sort of goes into your bloodstream somehow through your hair, through your head?
I didn't see any description of how it actually happens.
Yeah.
Smoking is the biggest cause of bladder cancer, but hair dyes... And that is... absolutely definitely recognised for hairdressers themselves, because of course they have more contact than we do with these dyes, because they're using them every day, several times a day probably. So they it increases their risk of bladder cancer 5 times, which is why there's a lot of advice that there should be really good ventilation in hairdressers' salons, and that they should wear gloves, and if you do it at home you should wear latex gloves as well.
So, OK, so that the gloves is one thing, but any other ways to reduce risk?
Yeah, yeah. The other cancer that it is linked with is leukemia and lymphoma and non-Hodgkin's disease. It more or less doubles your risk for those.
So more. It sounds, I mean, it's an incredible list of different health problems that this stuff can cause. Why do you think people still use these hair dyes? Is it just that people don't know that there are these health risks?
I don't think they do. I didn't know. I didn't know until I researched it myself. And what it's linked with, the longer you use these things, the darker the colour, that the pigment, the sort of colouring that produces a dark brown or black seems to be the one that has the most effects on you, then you're more likely to get the bad health effects.
So go for red hair, folks. If you've got to have a different colour, well, somewhat lighter than black or dark brown.
Don't dye it. Here's some tips then. Here's some tips. Either don't dye it, you know, or use temporary colour rather than the permanent, or go for a less dramatic colour change so that you don't have to use such strong chemicals on your hair. Don't go for such dark colours. Leave it on your head for a shorter time, maybe not the full 30 minutes. You can colour less hair by streaking and foiling, whatever that may be. But I think sometimes you walk past a hairdresser and people have got aluminium foil. I think that's what that is. You can ask for safe dyes. You know, you can ask them what dyes they're using. You can take your own dyes into the hairdressers if you manage to get some more eco-friendly ones. And for hairdressers, of course, they need good ventilation in the salons and gloves, because it's a very popular occupation for young people to go into. Most of the people in hairdressing are under 35, and it's something like the 10th most popular type of apprenticeship. So there's a lot of people going into this, so they do need their health protected. And if you want to bleach your hair, you can do it without ammonia. Use lemon juice and sunshine.
Okay. Now, you talked about the environmental impact as well. Let's just go back, return finally to that. What do you think is doing to the environment going into the wastewater? Because I wouldn't imagine that it's the sort of thing that ordinary filtering of water could necessarily cope with those chemicals.
No, you're quite right, because it goes down the plug hole. You know, it's used... People use hair dye about 100 million times a year in Britain. So 100 million times a year, the sort of excess hair dye is going down the plug hole, goes into the wastewater treatment plant, where it's not dealt with as such. It just goes through. So then it'll go back into the rivers and everything. Well, and it accumulates in the sea. And
the first thing I'd say is surely it should really go down the toilet rather than down the sink, because there's two different systems out there, aren't there? There's wastewater and... OK, so any more about the environment?
Well, what surprises me is that there is very little research on this. You would think that there would be a lot. And I've managed to find a project at Leeds University that was... got going in 2012, but I haven't seen any results yet. But they're particularly looking at, you know, what happens when hair dye goes down the plug hole and how it affects the environment. But generally speaking, it's not good to have it in the rivers and the sea. It can reduce the amount of plankton, and it can affect fish behaviour, and, you know, generally not a good thing to have all that pollution.
Surely the best thing to do is just, like, go with the flow. If you're losing the colour of your hair, you can look quite nice. I mean, we had our leader of Bristol City Council, Barbara Jank. She had lovely silvery hair, very nicely styled, and she was then made into a lady in the House of Lords, you know. So she looks great, but without any hair dye at all.
I think we're in a sort of culture where you feel unusual if you don't do it. It's kind of very normal to do it. So I think you could do with a few role models near the, you know, and who don't do it, and then start a new fashion. But of course, the people who would lose out of this, I mean, this is an industry worth billions of pounds. The hairdressers might not be very pleased, and certainly the manufacturers of the hair dyes.
There's also the psychological side to it, isn't it? It's almost like trying to push away the aging process. No, I'm not getting any older. I'm still... teenager, whatever, you know.
I know, that's very much part of it. But you also get, you know, 19-year-olds who are doing it, and they're not doing it because they don't want to go grey. It's just the thing to do.
I suppose the equivalent, and maybe we can look at this one future week, is men and their toupees, because it always looks so silly, I think, when men try and comb their hair backwards and forwards across the top when they're starting to go bald.
Well, an alternative is they shave their heads and then you can't see whether they're bald
completely
or not.
Or wear a hat. Anyway, Sideways with Sue Jones. Thank you very much again for talking about hair dye this week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm George Butler, and I'm the co-host of The Secret Truth, been broadcasting for about 10 years.
And you're based where, George?
Based in Austin, Texas.
Can you tell us a bit about your background?
Well, I've been a realtor most of my life, and about 10 years ago, I started broadcasting along with Charlotte Littlefield Brown on Genesis Communications Network out of Minneapolis, and the program is called The Secret Truth.
Now, you had a few problems with GCN. I know you're not on there anymore. Can you explain at all what caused that? Do you know?
Well, James Tracy, Dr. James Tracy, I interviewed him 30 days after the Sandy Hook shooting up there in Connecticut. And after that, we were off the air. We got fired, you know, and I think that's why we were fired, I think.
Okay. What was he saying that was so controversial?
Well, it was only 30 days after Sandy Hook, and he said that there were actors involved, and he thought it was a hoax.
Right. And what would the purpose of that be?
Well, it's to create gun rights type of furor and support for more and more gun rights, gun control.
That sort of thing. Okay, George. Now, radio show you do, The Secret Truth, can you tell us why you decided to – well, you haven't entirely given up your job in property or real estate. Why you decided to take to the microphone?
Well, I've never, you know, done broadcasting. Well, I did broadcasting when I was very young, sports talk broadcasting when I was 16, but that was not much, you know. But anyway, you know, we have here in Austin, we have Alex Jones, and we have an access channel that's very active also. And so we all got interested in the Patriot movement and the Patriot topics and issues. And I've been studying the world system for 35 years before Alex came along. But Alex Jones here he created a lot of interest in this area called, you know, patriotic or patriotism or the Patriot movement in Austin and in the country. So it created a lot of people that went out here and started their own programs.
So tell us a bit about Texas, because it's a little bit different to many of the other states, isn't it?
Yes, it's the largest. Alaska land-wise is the largest state, but within the continental U.S., Texas is the largest state with about 12 million people. But we have everything we need here. We have a lot of land, and we have oil and gas, farm, all kinds of crops. The petrochemical business here is very strong along the Gulf Coast. We have quite a long Gulf Coast and a lot of fisheries along there. So we have fishing, we have oil and gas and farm and ranching and things like that. That's sort of been the mainstays of the economy here in Texas.
And what would you say about the Texas character? Do Texans tend to be a bit more independent-minded maybe?
Yes, for example, 1 year after Waco, we were down in front of the Alamo. We've used the Alamo as a symbol to rally for, you know, people for certain rights and things like that. And we burned UN flags in front of the Alamo. We've gone down there. 1 year after Waco, we had a gun militia rally in front of the Alamo for gun rights and gun militia and stuff. So we're a very independent group of people here, but we really believe in liberty and freedom.
Okay, what's the significance of the Alamo historically, and maybe you can also mention what happened at Waco.
Well, 1836 was the Battle of the Alamo, and the first battle was in Gonzales, which is one of my hometowns for my family. Okay, but there was a cannon that come and take it. It's sort of the slogan in the Gonzales area, but that was the first battle, and then that created an influx, an invasion. No, it wasn't an invasion because Texas was part of the United states of Mexico at the time. Okay, we were a department of Coahuila, which was a state within the United States of Mexico called Tejas. Okay, and so we were Mexican citizens at that time. But they started wanting to confiscate our arms and tax us, which was outside the Constitution at the time. And Santa Anna was the leader at the time. And so he invaded. He came in with a force of Mexican army. And we had a big battle at the Alamo, which is downtown San Antonio today.
What about your own background? Have you had anything much to do with guns? Have you been in the forces, for example?
Yes, I was in the Army Security Agency in Europe for 3 years, and I ended up in West Berlin.
How did that, I suppose, color your view of world politics today?
Well, Men with Hill, we were coordinating and communicating with them daily out of England, and that's a big satellite interception site. And we were on top of a mound of rubble in West Berlin. So at 20, 22 years of age, I got sort of a taste of the intelligence business, okay, from the Army Security Agency was a agency that intercepted communications intelligence and signal intelligence. And those were our two of our basic jobs in the agency.
Now, you mentioned things like burning UN flags, and a lot of people around the world would say, well, hang on, America's got no right to do that because some of the US foreign policy has just run roughshod over UN policy. They, you know, keep using the veto and things like that.
John Kennedy, when he was president, was working with the UN on arms control, an international arms controls initiative, okay? And, of course, Texans didn't like some of that because Texans want to hold on to their arms, and the Second Amendment means a lot to Texans, okay? And today we have probably more guns per family than any, you know, state in the Union, and we're not going to give up our guns because we fought off the Mexicans during the Texas Revolution and won, and we know what it means to have guns and be armed.
I mean, just give us an example, because it's very not normal at all, you know, in here in Britain to have firearms. I mean, for example, your family and people you know, I mean, where do they have quite a lot of guns? Do they train young people to use guns and that sort of thing?
Well, the younger generations don't do as much as we grew up at 10 and 12 years of age with guns. I lived inside of a city here in Austin, but I would walk to the edge of town with a rifle at 12 years of age and go hunting out on land that was adjacent to the city, and nobody would ever say anything.
So hunting for what?
At 12 years of age, we never shot anyone. We never shot windows out, and we really respected everyone at 12 years.
What were you hunting for? What animals were you hunting for?
Well, there were like rats and field mice and rabbits and things like that.
And I mean, also, George, a lot of people will point the finger at the United States and say, you've got a terrible homicide rate. And one of the main reasons is it's so easy for almost anybody to have a handgun or you know, some kind of firearm.
Well, what they've done is the liberal left has demonized the gun itself. It still takes a society... A deranged person or something to, you know, murder is still a crime, period. And you can murder in a lot of different ways with swords or clubs or whatever.
Anyway, what do you make of what the U.S. is projecting its force around the world? Because a lot of people now see it after the Second World War as some kind of giant empire that seems to be trying to take over countries.
Well, it's the corporate problem that we're dealing with, and it's the financial corporate problem that is dominant, and they're meeting right now in Davos, okay? And the world financial banking cartel is one that's really causing us a problem, and it's evolved into a fascist, a very corporate fascist system that doesn't care about individual citizens no matter where they're at.
A lot of people will point the finger at you as ordinary Americans saying, you know, you've got to sort out your own government because it's causing problems around the world.
We as individuals have become separated. Our leadership had become very evil in some of these foreign wars, and we're not approving of that. And I think that's one of the reactions on this last election.
I was going to come to that. Donald Trump, what do you make of him, and what do you think are going to be the indications in the first few weeks and months whether, you know, which direction he's going to be taking the U.S. empire?
Well, I talked to a lot of Democrats that voted for Trump, okay? And the reason why they voted for Trump was that the control group, the top leadership in the world, the real top leadership and elites were backing Hillary, and BlackRock was one of them, managing $4.5 trillion. So they saw all these big power people backing Hillary, and they said, we're going to go for Trump then, because with that many power people and dominant people, money people backing Hillary, Trump must be there. They were against Trump, so we're for Trump.
Well, that's a shame, isn't it, when you've got to vote for somebody just because you're against somebody else. But anyway, what about things to watch with Trump? Because he's, for example,
I don't like the Goldman Sachs people around Trump, because out of Goldman Sachs has come most of the chairmen of the New York Fed, which is dominant, over the Fed system itself. And so I don't like the Goldman Sachs people around him. And what they've done is corral him with a lot of different influential, very right-wing, very conservative people, and don't like the Goldman Sachs people primarily.
Well, why do you point the finger at the Fed? Because many people would say, well, look, I mean, you know, money is not neither here nor there. It just flows where it needs to flow. What's the problem with the Fed?
In 1913, G. Edward Griffin wrote a book called The Creature of Jekyll Island. And there was a concerted effort to take over our money creation, the power of money creation, and a private financial banking group did that with the Federal Reserve. It's not constitutional.
So anything that can be done about that? It seems if a private interests have taken over your money, you've got a problem.
We supported Ron Paul in 2008 and 2012, but they weren't going to let him in the White House, so they shut the door on him.
What makes you think Trump might be different?
Well, for one thing, almost to a great number of people that were in high positions, that's Brennan and all these people, all of a sudden came out against him. And so that told me that he wasn't easily controlled by the big money.
But surely, I mean, you know, within a few weeks, they'll have him under their thumb.
Well, I don't know. He's going in and talking about pharmaceuticals. They're too high. They're too expensive. He's hammering big industries, and they're going to be his enemy. That's for sure.
George, what about this whole situation that's been cooking up for decades in the Middle East? Because it seems to be kind of at the in a kind of epicenter, in a way, of some of the problems in the world, with many things like the Arab Spring, the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya, sort of spiraling around the center of this conflict that's been brewing up between Iran and Israel. I wonder what you make of the causes of that and where it might be heading.
The Israeli lobby, AIPAC, is a organization here in the United States that's heavily influenced by the Israeli lobby. It is the Israeli lobby, and they have a lot of power in this country over Congress. And so the Israeli lobby with the Mossad and the CIA have been running this country. And so they don't want a settlement in the Middle East. They want to drive out the Palestinians and take the land. And so that we're not going to see any peace over there between those groups.
What about Iran then?
Iran is a very powerful country and a very highly populated country developing nuclear weapons. And Iran and Turkey together are going to be the main influences in the Middle East in the future.
Well, some have said that actually they've just got a nuclear energy program, and that actually that any country is allowed to do that under these international treaties.
Yeah, I see Iran maybe already having nuclear weapons. Okay, and so they're very aggressive, and they are Shiites. which is are in opposition to the Sunnis. So that's going to continue to be a battle in the Middle East.
But hang on, George. I mean, Iran is in the Middle East. They point the finger at the United States, who comes from halfway across the world.
We have been meddling all over the world where we shouldn't be. We shouldn't be in these foreign entanglements. And that's what Ron Paul was against.
Okay, any chance, because Trump has hinted at this, that he doesn't want any more of these kind of entanglements, hasn't he?
The problems I see with Trump is that he's too close to the Israelis and he has too many Goldman Sachs people in there already. And those are not good omens for his future. He's going to do some important things like immigration, start controlling that, which we needed to do for years ago that Obama wouldn't do. But so some of the big items that he set out will be done. But as far as anything in the Middle East, he's buddies with Netanyahu and all that group.
I mean, you've been living in Austin for a while now. What changes have you seen in just the kind of number of people that have got decent jobs, the kind of income people have got in Austin, Texas?
Well, Austin has been an exception to the nation as a whole, and we've had a very, very strong economy and an excellent real estate economy market here. So Austin is an exception nationwide, and we also have high tech coming in all over the state too. And Texas Instruments was a homegrown company here. IBM is strong here in Austin, and Tracor was another one that was founded here in Austin. So we've had some high tech people mixed in with oil and gas and farm and ranching and fisheries and things like that. We have a very strong economy.
Okay, what about other parts of the U.S. and, you know, other cities?
Well, the Midwest is really bad because of all the auto industry-related industries that moved out, you know. And the Midwest is probably the slowest or the worst area in the country. That's why Trump could gather support from that. From there,
I mean, generally, people's incomes in the West, I mean, not just the United States, have been going down really since the 1980s in terms income.
Yeah, just since Obama's been in office, the jobs that we've lost have been offset by the creation of jobs. But we traded at the beginning of his administration, the $26 an hour jobs turned into $13 an hour jobs today.
How is that?
Because we've had industry move out, and the jobs that are remaining are like food service and service related industries.
So is Trump going to be able to turn that around? I know he said he wants to.
He's already attracted some industry back to the U.S. already, and he's very positive. He's a wheeler dealer, and he knows business, so I think he will help, but it'll take several years to have an impact.
The other problem, of course, is he's only one man, and if he's going to surround himself with hawks and also with these people from Goldman Sachs, surely he's going to be outmaneuvered.
That's right. And Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, is also Jewish, but has very strong ties to Israel and the Jewish religion also. So that's where they all tie back to Netanyahu. And so that doesn't bode well there for treating the Palestinians right.
Okay, so what do you think are going to be the first indications in 2017 as to which way things are going to go with Trump? Whether it almost seems to me like the U.S. has voted for Trump in a way to try and improve the U.S. record in the world, because under Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, there's been this emphasis on foreign policy, which has made most of the rest of the world point its finger at the United States as saying, you guys are out of line.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point, Tony. The average person out there does not want us. They do not want these wars, not the average person, and they want jobs. And Trump made, he reached out to them on that. I've watched almost every speech he made on his campaign trail, and those were very important points. And the control of immigration also was an important. But basically, people felt like he had the nation's best interest at heart. And I believe he does over the previous regime, that's for sure.
But the U.S. was built on immigration.
Well, but not unrestricted like it has evolved under Obama. It's gotten way out of control. He's actually busing people in, flying people in. It's out of control. Even your ICE people, your Border Patrol people will tell you they don't like the policies now. It's too unrestricted.
The other thing, of course, is you've got big restrictions on civil liberties there. I mean, a lot of people actually even avoid coming to a U.S. airport now because you get loads and loads of kind of security, personal searches and all that sort of thing. This security state seems to be growing and growing in the United States, almost like a kind of George Orwell 1984 style situation, authoritarian. Is there any way, do you think, that Trump might be able to turn that particular tank around?
Trump is what we call in the personality classification talk, you know, or discussion, a authoritarian personality type. And those kinds of personalities tend to favor authoritarian types of systems. And that's not good for Trump, for the country.
Also, George, have you got a vision yourself for the United States that you would like to see and that, you know, decent people in America would like to see, a kind of U.S. branching out in a different direction and maybe addressing some of the problems at home rather than focusing always abroad?
Exactly, Tony. We need to get back to rebuilding our economy and rebuilding our job base. And that's not disallowing people from coming in, but people that immigrate in, we need to know who they are.
The Mexican border is very long. Is he really going to build this wall?
No, that's more symbolic than anything. There won't be a wall along every foot of the border. Nuh-uh.
So
there are certain places where there's high crossover where walls could be helpful, but it'll be more electronic, and they'll just start enforcing the laws, which they haven't been doing in the last under Obama's administration.
I mean, you're quite close to the border there.
Yes.
Is it really easy to get backwards and forwards for Mexicans to come in?
You can walk across about anywhere along the border. That you can. It's just open, really. You might have to, you know, wade across low water, you know, or swim across a small, you know, part of the Rio Grande. The Rio Grande is not a raging river in places. It's a very small river, really, in places. And you can easily see across it just a few hundred yards or less, you know, and it's wide open. There's no fences or anything in most of the border right now.
If there is a crash, how will ordinary Americans cope?
Well, we have a lot of, in the Patriot movement, we have a lot of people that are preparing, or preppers in this country, and they're preparing themselves to, we have flexibility in existing on a whole lot less than what we have now.
Because they had in Russia around about 1990, complete economic collapse, and they were able to, for example, people that lost their jobs in the towns go and stay with friends and relatives and family in the country, and then actually start working on the land and feed themselves that way. But, I mean, would Americans be able to do the same?
We have plenty of land here in Texas where we can feed ourselves on our own land.
But can you see a similar kind of scenario happening in the U.S.? Because a lot of people are pointing at the financial situation, particularly you yourself said there, you know, you've got this problem with the Fed, that it's being run for private interests rather than for the interests of the country. And if it does go bang, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of things that could trip it over the edge. Will it be similar to, do you think, to what happened in the 1990 Russia?
I don't think so. We have a lot of people with a lot of land still. We can do with a lot less. We can cut down on our driving appreciably, and we can really tighten our belts and probably make it through a bad era.
Okay, George Butler, just like to tell us whereabouts we can find you online and follow your radio shows.
Right, it's www.thesecrettruth.com, www.thesecrettruth.com. Yeah.
George Butler from Austin, Texas, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Okay, thank you, Tony. Have a good one.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, the mainstream media hasn't told us, hasn't told me, and it hasn't told you. So we're telling you. This guy's James Files. He's in prison in the United States, and he's the man who killed John F. Kennedy. Sounds unbelievable, doesn't it? But here he is. He was working for the Chicago Mafia, and he was brought down to Dallas, Texas, and fired the fatal shot that killed the President of the United States back in 1963. So here's James Files, and the extract from a talk by him. There's a link on our show page if you want to hear that, which is the full interview, which is www.dialectradio.co.uk. And here's Files talking about James Ferry, Lee Harvey Oswald, and he's explaining the mystery of the death of Officer Tippit.
This is Kennedy we're talking about. You know, to me, I never liked Kennedy. I don't even know why I ever did it. I don't even know why the FBI gave Joe West the lead on me. I've never understood that one. The Tippit killing is not related to the murder of Kennedy, if you want to get right down to it. The Tippit killing is related to Oswald, because Oswald was the one that was supposed to die, not Tippit. Tippit's one of these people that just stopped the wrong person that got caught in the wrong place. And when he went to ask a party something, and you've got an officer in Round Lake Beach by the name of David Ostertag, and when he goes out and gives his tours and he talks, he tells people how careful they have to be, these young recruits, because you never know who you're stopping. Somebody should have given that talk to J.D. Tippit, because he stopped the wrong party and got him killed.
So the party that killed Tippit, though, was actually out trying
They was to after Lee Harvey Oswald.
Make a statement to that.
Okay. The party that killed J.D. Tippit, they wasn't there to kill J.D. Tippit. They had parked a little ways from Oswald's boarding house. They'd went down there to kill Oswald. They wanted to kill Oswald. They didn't want to make a big spectacle out of it. They wanted to silence him at that point of the game, before anybody can get to him. But I guess, I don't know if Lee got spooked or whatever it was, but then he went to the theater, and he knew where he was going when he left there, because he was supposed to meet the controller there, which is David Atlee Phillips. He was the one that's supposed to be at the theater, as far as I understand.
How do you know?
In my understanding with Lee Harvey Oswald, when this is over, that he was going to be in contact with David Atlee Phillips. I did not know that David Phillips was going to be at the theater, but I knew Oswald was going to go meet him. My understanding was with Lee that he was going to meet his controller, which was David Phillips, who was my controller. He was going to meet him. I didn't know that it was going to be at a theater. I have no knowledge of that at that point. But if Lee Harvey Oswald ran to a theater, that had to be where the meeting was going to take place. Lee must have left this house earlier for whatever reason. I don't really know. But the party that went there didn't find Lee there. And when he started to leave, he was stopped by the police. This is when he shot Tippit. What transpired there, I can't tell you who saw this guy there. I can't tell you whether he ran. I can't tell you whether he walked. I don't know. All I understand is this. A party that I know that come by my motel room told me he had to burn a cop. The cop he burned was J.D. Tippit. That was the only cop killed in Dallas that day, so it had to be the one that he burned. At this point, he says, here, you want to get rid of that? So I said, hell no, take it. You get rid of your own weapon. I said, I got my own problems. Get out of here. Go. When it comes down to the part of this guy going for Lee Harvey Oswald, the connection is this. Lee Harvey Oswald had just spent 5 days with me. Lee Harvey Oswald knew who I was. He knew I was in town. He knew what just happened. It was tied to me basically drastically. When I talked to Charles Nicoletti that morning, I told him this. I said, we got a slight problem. And I said, what's that? He asked me, he said, what's that, Jimmy? I said, Lee Harvey Oswald. And at that time, Mr. Nicoletti said, Jimmy, he said, who's Lee Oswald? He said, never heard of this guy. I said, he works with the agents, and he's one of David's Atlee Phillips people. Chuck didn't know who David Phillips was. And he told me, I said, he's a tie back to me. I'm a tie back to you. I said, this makes me nervous. I'm concerned about it. Mr. Nicoletti told me, he said, Jimmy, don't worry about it. So I'll talk to the boss. The only one he could have talked to was Sam. If he talked to Sam, Sam evidently told him, don't worry, I'll take care of it. The only party that Sam could have called, and that's Sam Gene Connor. That would have been David Phillips. David Phillips was in the area that day. I know that for a fact. I didn't see him. I didn't talk to him, but I know he was there. Anyway, this party that was there that killed J.D. Tippit, he was brought in at a last-minute notice that he had to be on standby. And wherever Phillips went, he usually kept several people around that he could use, people that he needed. Whether he needs them or not, they're going to be available. They always had, what are you going to call them, contract agents, operatives, cooperatives, or whatever. He's got people that he can use. If he needs something done, he can pick up a phone and have it initiated at a moment's notice. This party was evidently there on standby because he did not live in that area. That's why I was shocked to see him in my motel room. So evidently they took care of it that way.
Okay, so this party that shot Tippett, he was more connected to the agency than the mob.
To the agency. He wasn't tied to the mob. He might have done some work for him along the way, but he was strictly one of David Phillips' people, because he did not even know Charles Nicoletti.
Were you aware of anybody using radio communication in the plaza?
No, I was not.
Did you ever hear of a man named James Hicks or Jim Hicks?
I've heard the name, but I don't know him.
You already said you saw Richard Kane in the plaza.
Yes, Richard Kane was in the plaza.
Is there any chance he was a shooter?
There's all kind of chances, but like I say, do I know that? No. I can't say he was or he wasn't.
Do you think Mr. Nicoletti was aware of the identities of any other shooters other than you and himself?
If Mr. Nicoletti had been aware, he would have been made aware of it by Sam Giancana. And if he was aware of it, he wouldn't tell me. And if there was other shooters there, I can't see where anybody would tell Nicoletti. It's very possible that Sam and Sam Giancana and David Phillips could have been talking. But like I say, again, if I know everybody in that area and I get stopped, I can name every shooter there if there's other shooters there. I'm not saying there is other shooters. What I'm saying is this. I have no need to know of everybody that's involved in an operation. What purpose would that serve? That's like me going into a communist country on a covert operation and me knowing everybody, all the other agents that are there in that field working. And if I get captured, they all get executed. Yeah. So the same thing goes when it comes down to crime. You try to keep your people the least bit of know as possible, because too many times, maybe, and that's like I can use one deal, like where one party back east there out of Philadelphia, I did time with him in the federal prison. His own brother gave him up. His brother knew that he was a big-time cocaine dealer. He was a dentist. They call him Dr. Snow. I don't remember his real name, but they call him Dr. Snow. His brother got busted with a nickel bag of weed in New York. He gave his own brother up because he couldn't do a year in the jail. His brother told him, I'll give you $1 million a year. For every year they keep in jail, I'll give you $1 million cash. Don't testify against me. He put his brother in jail.
Do you know Anthony Vinciano?
Yes, I did. I did know Antonio Vinciano, yes.
And how did you know him?
I met him in Miami, and he was tied up with the JM Wave. He was also tied up with the Alpha Group. He knew all the upper people. He was a little higher up in the ranks, but I met him. And did you ever meet somebody you just like? Well, I don't know. I liked him. He liked me. You know, we had a good rapport. He's good sense of humor. He could talk to you, you know, and he didn't talk down to you.
Tell us about Jim Wave.
JM Wave, that was a special operation set up for a lot of broadcasting, and we had a lot of people running a lot of covert activities out of it. It was basically a radio station there for doing a lot of propaganda stuff. That was all under David Phillips.
And where was that located?
That was in Miami.
Where in Miami?
Oh, God. Out towards Homestead there.
Okay, tell us about David Ferry.
David Ferry. I won't get into his personal lifestyle. David Ferry, I did not like David Ferry. I'd only seen him on one or two occasions. Me, I'm going to say he looked like a creep, more or less. He was stocky, built heavy set. He had real heavy eyebrows and... basically, I didn't like the guy because he was a homosexual, okay?
Do you know anything?
Child molester, as far as I'm concerned. I knew a lot of things about what he was doing. I didn't approve of it. But I'd like to say one thing about David Ferry. He was a solid agent for the CIA. He was on their payroll. I don't care what anybody says.
You know anything about David Ferry's
case? Yes, I do. He died of cerebral brain hemorrhage. But the cerebral brain hemorrhage that David Ferry had, that was brought on. And I explained to Corner, and I had this checked out. He went and talked to him. I don't know who all they talked to or anything else. But I also know that when Warden Godinez was the warden here at Stateville Prison, it was on a Sunday morning, they made a call up here. They wanted to come up and talk to me, some people. I'm not sure who it was that wanted to come talk to me. They said they had a Learjet on standby. And my reply was, save you fuel. I got nothing to say to you. But the tissue tear in the brain itself was just above the palate of the mouth. The hemorrhage was inflicted.
Ice pick?
No, sir. Nail file. Nail file gives you the stimulation of tear. You could use a stiletto, thin blade knife, ice pick, but then you'd see what it is. You'd get a clean cut. With a fingernail file, you got a smooth edge, you got a perforated edge, And when it goes through the tissue, it's like a tear. It's like something ripping apart.
Do you know who did that?
Yes, I do.
Was it you?
Was it me? Of course not. Not me. I wouldn't do that. I'm not admitting to a murder on there. JFK's bad enough, but nobody wants to prosecute me for JFK.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Sue Jones, Sideways with Sue Jones this week, investigated hair dye. Also, thanks to George Butler from Austin, Texas, The Secret Truth Show. And finally, thanks to Wim Dankbar, who's the Dutch guy who interviewed James Files, the assassin that killed John F. Kennedy. And thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bezanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897. Online at prsc.org.uk. You can also go on to the Volunteering Bristol website for all volunteering in the city. That's 0117 989 7733 online at volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the national volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Waiting.